Wah bam bloom bam blam bam bam. From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week we speak with filmmaker Alex Cox about directing punk rock-infused classics like Repo Man, Walker, and Sid and Nancy.
There was a studio interested in funding a film about Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, which would star Rupert Everett and Madonna. And I thought this must not be allowed to happen.
Plus, we'll review the new album from N.E.R.D., Pharrell Williams' side project.
Bouncing around, bouncing around, bouncing. Bouncing around, bouncing around, bouncing. Scrunching the ad with your name in their mouth. Bouncing around, bouncing around, bouncing.
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later on in the show, Jim, we are going to review this new N.E.R.D. record. This is a Pharrell Williams side project, if you will. This is now the fifth studio album by this band, and first in 7 years, No One Really Ever Dies is the name of the record.
N.E.R.D. is the project where Pharrell goes into the garage, Greg. And garage bands, of course, are a great tradition in rock and roll. I think no one in the filmmaking world ever has captured better the punk DIY garage spirit than director Alex Cox. Politically charged films, surreal films, impeccable soundtracks, always, starting with his debut in 1984, the cult classic Repo Man. What is Repo Man about? People repossessing cars, but it's this surreal science fiction comedy. Emilio Estevez and Harry Dean Stanton star. I think it's less important for the story than the look and the sound. On the soundtrack, a bunch of L.A. punk heavy hitters, Black Flag, Suicidal Tendencies, Fear, and of course, the great Iggy Pop.
You know, he followed that up, Jim, with another great cult movie, Sid and Nancy, in 1986. It was a biopic about the Sex Pistols' Sid Vicious and his girlfriend Nancy Spungen and that tragic descent into heroin addiction. Later on, he collaborated with Joe Strummer of The Clash, the most notable aspect of two films, Straight to Hell and Walker. And he's continued to be prolific ever since. His most recent is a Western, Tombstone Rashomon.
We're happy to welcome Alex Cox, director of some of our favorite movies, to Sound Opinions.
Really? Do you really mean that?
I really mean that, Alex. If I had a dime for every band I've interviewed who told me we decided to become a band after seeing Repo Man, all right, or that scene in Sid and Nancy when the schoolgirls are running down the street smashing headlights with lacrosse sticks.
Yeah, we've got to do that.
And then everybody says, yeah, we're going to be in rock and roll. But, you know, at first we have to start with how you grew up. I mean, you're obviously an Englishman.
I am.
But it seems to us that your filmic consciousness was formed here in the States. And you went, because you went to UCLA, right? After Oxford?
Yeah, I was a law student at Oxford when I was an undergraduate. Then I was at film school in Bristol in England for a year. And then I got a Fulbright to go to UCLA. Mm. And I was a student at UCLA for 3 years.
You were no slacker, sir.
So I was an academic. You know, I come from the groves of academe.
So you arrive at UCLA, what, at 77, right?
Yes.
You know, music is such a big part of your films. The soundtracks are revered as the films are in many ways. What was your musical background coming into film school in 77, and how did it change when you got to UCLA?
Well, it's interesting because, I'm from Liverpool, so we had the Beatles. So
sure.
At one point, all you ever had to say was, you came from Liverpool, and people would go, Los Beatles, you know. No matter where you were, and that's probably changed now. But at the time, so being from Liverpool was always a calling card that you could use. But the 70s was, it's thought of a little bit of a kind of as a kind of a musical desert until punk started. Even though there was interesting stuff happening, there was Bowie, there was Roxy Music, there was sure. Brian Eno, there was the sensational Alex Harvey Band. Did you ever listen to them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there was Alice Cooper in the States. So there was interesting stuff going on. But then 76, 77, when the punk thing kicked in, I remember being in Bristol and seeing a member of a band called the Cortinas, walking down the street in his leather jacket. And as he went by, I looked at what it said on it, the back of his jacket, and it said 1976. And the year was 1976. And I thought, oh, wow, this is something quite important. And a year later, I was in Los Angeles, not really having been exposed to the English music scene at all, or the punk scene. And so I grew up punk-wise with the Los Angeles bands.
Sure.
You know, with Fear, with Suicidal Tendencies, with the X,
Germs.
With the Plugs. Not so much Germs. I was never a Germs or a Derby Crash fan, although many people were. But I was like, Fear I loved, X I loved, the Plugs I loved. The early Go-Go's, you know, before they became a pop group.
People forget how ferocious they were early on.
They were fantastic.
So your UCLA Film School, your films were groundbreaking in a number of ways. You kind of reimagined some of these tropes that came out of Hollywood and sort of did them in your own kind of image and vision. What was going on there that influenced your idea of presenting this information visually?
Well, what was going on at UCLA, I think, was that I was in a really polyglot community for the first time because I came from, you know, a fairly white background. And it wasn't until I got to Los Angeles that I actually had friends who were black, Native American, especially Latino. I knew so many people from who were either, you know, Chicanos or people from Latin America. And so that was the interesting thing for me, was that it really was a polyglot environment and a very fructiferous environment, and a lot of stuff was happening, a lot of interesting stuff was happening.
I shall not cause harm to any vehicle, nor the personal contents thereof, nor through inaction let that vehicle or the personal contents thereof come to harm. It's what I call the repo code, kid. Don't forget it, etch it in your brain. Not many people got a code to live by anymore.
Repo Man, how did it get made? 1984, as I said, changed many a generation of musicians' lives. Those kids who were too young to experience the Ramones and the Sex Pistols and the Clash firsthand. The artistic vision that unites Repo Man, the lighting, the casting, the dialogue, the music, it is such of a piece. All of it screams punk. We are here. We are different. We are individuals.
Wow, that was intense.
Repo Man's always intense.
Come on, let's go get a drink.
Well, the original deal with Repo Man was that we were trying, the producers and I, I'd been at UCLA with, we were trying to raise $100,000 to make it as an independent film. Mm-hmm. We thought we could meet like 10 dentists, each of whom would give us $10,000 and do it that way. But we never met any dentists, you know, and we didn't go to the dentists because we didn't have enough money, you know, so we completely failed in our attempt to recruit dentist investors. We did meet a guy called Michael Nesmith.
Of the Monkees.
Of the Monkees, mm-hmm. Formerly of the Monkees, who'd lost all of his Monkees money. He'd had his cars repossessed, so that was a very poignant experience for him. And then his mother, who lived in Texas, invented a product called liquid paper.
Whiteout.
Whiteout. And they were millionaires again.
Mm-hmm.
And Nesmith took the project around the studios, all of whom rejected it. One evening, Nesmith found himself in a bar in Los Angeles called Morton's. Mm. And this was the time of Urban Cowboy.
I was looking for love in all the wrong places. Looking for love in too many faces.
And there were a number of studio executives there, all dressed in Western-style jumpsuits. Nesmith was being courted by the agent of Kenny Rogers, or the manager of Kenny Rogers, who wanted to become Nesmith's agent.
Mm.
And so the manager says, well, what are you working on today, Michael? What are your projects at the moment? And Michael goes, well, I've been trying to get this film Repo Man off the ground, but you know, we haven't really been very successful. And the manager goes, well, isn't that Bob Ramey, head of Universal Pictures, over there at the bar in the cowboy jumpsuit? And Nesmith goes, yeah, I think it is. And the manager snaps his fingers, Bob, get over here. Hey, hey, you know. Yeah. And Bob Ramey, the head of the studio, comes running over. Yes, yes, how may I be of service, you know. And the manager goes, hey, I hear that that you've turned down this great script, Repo Man. Isn't that what it's called, Michael? And I goes, yeah, yeah. And Ramey goes, oh, I'm not sure we've turned it down exactly. I don't think we've passed on it yet. And this manager guy goes, you should make that. It's going to be a great movie. He didn't know anything about it at all. He's just showing Nesmith what his influence can be.
Yeah, yeah.
Next day, Nesmith gets a call from Ramey's assistant, Tom Mount. And Mount says, well, you know that film we passed on? What was it called? And Nesmith goes, Repo Man. And he goes, yeah, well, I guess we're making it after all, you know?
Oh, man.
Do you think they give a damn about their bills in Russia? I said, do you think they give a damn about their bills in Russia?
They don't pay bills in Russia. It's all free.
All free? Free my ass. What are you, f***ing commie? Huh?
No, I ain't no commie.
Well, you better not be. I don't want no commies in my car. No Christians either.
Now, Repo Man didn't do well at the box office at first. In fact, it only opened, I believe, in three cities.
It opened only, I think, in two. They played it in Chicago for a week and in Los Angeles for a week, and then it went straight to video.
Yeah. But this afterlife, since?
Well, because of the album. The album saved it. Uh-huh. Because they were selling so many copies of the album. At that time, Universal was a division of MCA Music Company. And a guy called Irwin Azoff, was the head of MCA,
Irving Azoff,
who was the head of MCA Music, called his homologue over at Universal Pictures, Lou Wasserman, and said, hey, you know this album, Repo Man? Selling a lot of copies of that. Is there a movie that goes with it?
I'm not drinking! Here's the dessert! Get what I'm drinking!
Well, all your favorite bands are on this soundtrack.
Of that time,
and
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So, did you have film scenes with the music in mind, or how did that work?
Only in the case of the Circle Jerks scene, where they play a lounge band. In the film itself.
Doobity doo wop wop, say what, yeah.
And there was also a song by Black Flag called TV Party, which was in the original screenplay. That when Otto sits on the tracks all miserable and then tries to, you know, get his spirits up by singing, we're going to have a TV party tonight. All right.
All right.
We're just dedicated to our favorite shows.
Saturday Night Live! Monday Night Football! Dallas! Jefferson, Gilligan's Island, Flintstone.
Those two songs were sort of embedded in the film from the beginning, and the rest just came along. And the most surprising thing for me was that the Plugs, whom I knew a little bit just from going to shows, turned out to be like really good composers of film soundtrack music.
Wow. So they provided the
And they provided the whole of the soundtrack based on the song that Iggy wrote. Because Iggy had shown up in L.A. to check out the scene, you know, and to try and become, to see what this punk thing was all about, you know. And even though he lived in New York, but he left his apartment in Bleecker Street and moved to L.A. because the scene seemed to be more interesting there, or he thought it was. And so Iggy wrote the main theme, and the Plugs wrote a number of variants on the main theme and then departed from that completely for the whole soundtrack of the picture.
This might be an apocryphal story, but I heard Iggy summoned you to where he was staying in L.A., to see if you were going to be okay for him to write something for.
To
check you out.
We first met at a screening of the film. And he'd already read the script. I mean, this is what he does. He reads the script. He sees the film.
Yeah.
He writes the song, you know. And so I went to see him at his home subsequently, his apartment, just to listen to what he was working on. Mm-hmm. And then when they did the recording, he brought in, I think, a couple of guys from Blondie and Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols.
Ah.
So his band was really quite stellar.
I was riding on a concrete slab down the river of a useless lab. It was such a beautiful day. I heard a witch doctor say, I'll tear you into a toadstool. I'm looking for the joke with a microscope. A muscle twitching auto swerves. You want to speak, you lose your nerve.
Was that the first time you met one of the Pistols?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Although I didn't really... I mean, you know, Steve Jones showed up and it was time to play, and so we just kind of waved at them and left, you know.
But. Because that brings us to Sid and Nancy, 1986. Yeah. I mean, it is such a definitive film, not only for that story, which is tragic and fascinating, but for that era. Like I said, the girls with the lacrosse sticks, right? And just as like all of London is exploding and bubbling under or bubbling over. And you capture that so well, but you weren't there.
No.
So what draws you to this band's story less than a decade after they flamed out?
Well, I really liked the Pistols. They're a very good band. And I thought particularly, in a funny way, after the Pistols broke up, I kind of thought that some of the stuff that then happened, like My Way, was even better. You know, although I love Pretty Vacant. I thought that was a wonderful song.
There's no point in asking, you'll get no reply. I've just seen him, but I don't despise. I got no reason, it's not too much. You'll always find us out to lunch.
I was more of a Clash fan.
Yeah.
And I saw The Clash a couple of times in Los Angeles when they came. The Pistols never came. They were supposed to come to L.A., but they broke up at the Winterland in San Francisco and never played their L.A. gig. So none of us had ever seen the Pistols. But about a year after I'd done Repo Man and I was trying to get another project going, a producer came to me and said that there was a studio interested in funding a film about Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, which would star Rupert Everett and Madonna. And I thought, this must not be allowed to happen.
That would not have worked. No.
Yeah. And that's the origin of Sid and Nancy. So I got together with a friend of mine, Abby Wool, who had worked on the crew of Repo Man and was a good writer. And we wrote the script together really to try and preempt the disastrous studio film.
Preemptive strike.
Regrets, I've had a few. But then again, to future mention, I did what I had to do. I saw it through without exemption.
Well, Gary Oldman really owns that role. I mean, it's amazing.
Tremendous, isn't he?
Did you have him in mind when you started writing the script?
No. It was a casting director, Lucy Bolting, who's the London-based casting director, introduced me to several actors who could have played Sid. But the two top ones, the ones who did the best auditions and were really the most interesting, were Gary Oldman and another actor just starting out called Daniel Day-Lewis.
Not a bad choice either.
So they were both very good actors, and we were lucky to have such an incredible choice.
Yeah.
Dear Mum, guess where your Simon's turned up? Since you can't guess, I will tell you.
Paris, in the spring. Sid's recording here, and he's brilliant. We go shopping every day. Sid bought me lots of underwear, and it's all French. You'd love it here. Lots of love from Nancy and Sid.
The inherent tragedy of that romance, you know, one of the things, the film has a heart, and we're not judging Sid and Nancy, neither are we celebrating their sad decline. Was that something you were cautious about?
No, I think we should judge them. I think we should judge them more harshly. I mean, there's that scene when they go to the methadone clinic, and the character played by Cy Richardson tells them what screw-ups they are. You know, and that they actually have all these opportunities, and instead they're just two pieces of rubbish.
You guys got no right to be strung out on that stuff. You could be selling healthy anarchy. But long as you're addicts, you'd be full of shit.
Well, that's the point of view of the film. Okay. Unfortunately, I think it gets mitigated by the end because the end is quite sentimental.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been better probably to end the film with Sid like dying in a pool of his own vomit, you know, with pizza shards all lying around.
Well, it was a horrible end and a horrible story.
Yeah.
But
we might not have got the money to make the film if it had been that hard-edged.
Probably true.
Yeah.
Did you read Lester Bangs's famous piece about Sid
and Nancy? Oh, yes, I did. A Tale of Two Patsies.
Yes. Really bemoaned the waste of a life.
That was a very good article, and that was really inspiring. I think, actually, Lester Bangs' article, A Tale of Two Patsies, really was an inspiration to me and Abby in terms of finding our feet with the screenplay.
Yeah.
Because he really got it, you know. He really understood that they were both a pair of patsies.
Yeah.
But he also understood that there was this potential there that Sid really could have been an extraordinary artist.
But Sidney's more than a mere bass player. He's a fabulous disaster. He's a symbol, metaphor. He embodies the dementia of a nihilistic generation. He's a f***ing star.
There was the possibility of that.
Yeah.
And that it just all went pear-shaped. So messed up.
After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with filmmaker Alex Cox with a look at his collaboration and friendship with Joe Strummer of The Clash. And later, we're going to review the new album from eclectic hip-hop trio NERD. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott, my partner's Jim DeRogatis, and that's a little bit of Love Kills by Joe Strummer from the soundtrack of Sid and Nancy, a 1986 film about Strummer's punk rock contemporary Sid Vicious. We're joined this week by the film's director, Alex Cox. Strummer composed for and starred in a number of Cox's films, including Straight to Hell, a spaghetti western homage with an all-star punk cast including The Pogues, Courtney Love, Elvis Costello, Grace Jones. And then Strummer also wrote the score for Cox's very controversial 1987 film, Walker. But the collaboration really started with Sid and Nancy. Alex, how did your relationship with Joe Strummer develop?
Oh, it was just great. I met him in London at, we were having a rap party for the London shoot. And Joe and some other people that hadn't worked on the film but were kind of party animals came, you know. And so And I met him and I just thought, well, obviously this is one of my, you know, this guy is kind of my hero. Not that I'm going to tell him that, you know. Mm. But I said, you know, when we come back after we've shot the American part and we've got a rough cut, would you like to look at it, you know? And if you're interested, maybe you can write us a song, you know. And his record company, only permitted him officially to write two songs. But he wrote about five altogether. So there are three other songs. There's a reggae song. There's a country and western song. Sung by Pearl Harbor, which he did under assumed names.
Right.
One shot for him, one for his mom. Before they make love in his car.
Strummer, I found in talking to him, is a remarkably unassuming, very welcoming kind of guy to people he doesn't even need to be nice to. What did you find him to be like personally?
Well, I would say that was true up to a point, but I would also say that he was very tough and a very political animal as well, because you really couldn't be, you couldn't have been in the Clash without being, without having a certain very tough veneer and without being able to walk away from things. So I was fortunate in the way to see both sides of him. I mean, to see that what you describe as a very warm and very creative person, but also to see what a tough guy he could be when he needed to.
Then you cast him in Straight to Hell.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, you know, a fairly straightforward Sergio Leone homage, you know, spaghetti Western, done with your unique twist. Was that the goal? What were you trying to do with that film?
It's not an homage to Sergio Leone at all. It's an homage to another Italian Western called Se Vivo Spara, directed by Giulio Questi. It's a really interesting and perverse film. And we certainly didn't reach the glorious heights of Questi's film. But it was most fun to do. And it only came about because we had been planning to do a rock and roll tour of Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. We'd gone to these musicians, including the Pogues, Strummer, Elvis Costello, everybody made themselves available for a month-long tour of Nicaragua in the month of August, which we thought we could fund with money from a record company and a VHS pre-sale or a CD pre-sale. Totally failed. No record company wanted to put any money into such a left-wing and dangerous project.
Yeah.
And now we were in trouble because all these musicians had given up a month of their schedules for that tour. So the producer of the film said, maybe I should try and find money to make a film instead. Mm-hmm. And he did, because he went to Island Records, who just opened a film division, Island Films, and they, hey, yeah, a film with Joe Strummer and the Pogues and Elvis Costello in it, sure, we'll fund it, you know. So they gave us $1 million and went to Spain for 4 weeks, and that was the result.
Gun is just a tool. Ain't no better or no worse than the man that uses it.
Just like shoes.
Yeah.
What made you think Joe Strummer could be an actor?
Oh, I thought he definitely had something. The charisma going for him, didn't he? I mean, he had a really good look. Mm-hmm. He looked a little bit like the young Michael Caine. And you knew he could do it. I mean, there are some people, like Courtney Love, there are some people who aren't trained actors, but they've seen actors on television and in films, and they understand what's going on instinctively.
Well, for Courtney, all the world's a stage.
That's right.
Norman, we gotta go! There's a bunch of ruthless men in this town. We gotta get out of here right now!
Is that right?
Yes, that is right, Zip. I'm not talking to you.
So I think both of them, although they didn't have training as actors, they could do it, you know. And then there were other people in the film, you know, like Shane McGowan of the Pogues, who really aren't actors. Shane could never understand why he had to do the same thing twice, you know. You know, I did that on the last take. I'm going to go that direction on this take. Yeah. You know? But certainly both Joe and Courtney, I think, were instinctive actors.
It is the God-given right of the American people to dominate the Western Hemisphere. It is our moral duty to protect our neighbors from oppression and exploitation. It is the fate of America to go ahead. That is her manifest destiny.
Hear, hear!
We are talking with director Alex Cox on Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. I'm here with Greg Kot. Alex, your next project was Walker, and a lot of critics consider it your best film. It's this weird footnote in American history, starring Ed Harris as William Walker, an American who goes to Nicaragua in the 1850s and declares himself president.
Does Nicaragua mean anything to you, Walker?
Nothing at all.
This worthless piece of real estate controls the overland route to the Pacific. I now control all transportation in Nicaragua. But in order to continue to do so, I need stability.
What's this got to do with me?
Nicaragua is a divided country, sir. It is in the midst of a terrible civil war. It is imperative.
What I need is for some man to go down there and take over.
I mean, there's American imperialism in a nutshell, you know, and it comes out at this point with Reagan and Nicaragua and what's happening in South America. What a strange and wonderful movie.
You couldn't make that stuff up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Walker has a reputation for being this really crazy film on the basis of some anachronisms. But everything that happens in the film really happened. Oh, no, helicopters didn't land.
Right.
But all the events took place as we depict them. And I think that's what was really upsetting to a number of people when the film came out, was that we didn't mitigate it in any way. Because the normal way of making a political film in Britain or the USA is to show these terrible events through the eyes of a sympathetic journalist. You know? Mm-hmm. And we didn't do that.
You listen to that Strummer soundtrack, and that, you know, it was an amazing piece of work, and you don't, you know, it puts him in a completely different realm. It recontextualizes what you think about Joe Strummer in many ways.
Yes, because he's written an authentic film soundtrack.
Right. Tell us about Strummer composing for Walker. Did you give him any direction at all?
I know nothing about music. I completely am dependent upon the composer because I know nothing. We were in Nicaragua for 9 weeks shooting, and then when the shoot was over, I and the editor and the producer and Joe stayed for another 2 months to edit. And it was during that time that Joe started coming up with the music, which he was just, you know, creating in a very simple way. He would come and play things on a little cassette tape player. And gradually, it became apparent that it wasn't going to be one of those composite scores. Because up until then, all the scores I'd done were different bands, different people contributing to an overall soundtrack. And at one point, we were going to get in the car and go to Managua and meet Carlos Mejia Godoy, who was a very prominent Nicaraguan folk musician, and we were going to ask him to write a song for it. La tumba del guerrillero, donde está? El pueblo está preguntando, algún día lo sabrá. And just before we got in the car, Joe goes, you know, Alex, I've been thinking, you know, I mean, how would it be if instead of having one of those composite soundtracks, your soundtrack was all written by one person?
Mm.
And I said, who would that person be? So we didn't get in the car and we didn't go and meet Carlos Mejia Godoy. And Joe wrote the entire soundtrack.
Didn't have to ask you twice.
But you see how political and how intelligent he was and how he waited until the moment was right? And it was literally car doors open to go to Managua. You know, I've been thinking maybe we should stay here and just do the soundtrack here. And the only other instance that I can think of that's at all similar is what Bob Dylan did with Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Mm. When Dylan was on set playing a subsidiary role throughout the film and getting the feel of the thing and starting to write music while he was still there, Dylan and Rudy Wurlitzer wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door on the flight from Durango back to Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Rudy wrote the words for Knocking on Heaven's Door, but Dylan never gave him a credit.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Wurlitzer was also involved in this movie, right?
He wrote the script.
In Walker,
he wrote the script for both films.
So this is interesting, because Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is one of my favorite movies, too.
It's a great film.
And why do you love it so much? What is it about that movie that appealed to you? That it was used? It seemed like it was a stepping-off point in some ways for Walker.
I think now, looking at it now, I think it's perhaps the most political Western ever made. And it's also a very good Western. But at the time, why I thought Rudy was right for Walker was that Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid seemed to me to be a film about two guys who are creating their own legends by climbing up a pile of dead bodies.
How does it feel?
It feels like times have changed.
Times, maybe. Not me.
And in both cases, what they really seek is their own demise. But it takes them such a long time to get there that they wreak havoc along the way. And, of course, that's the story of Walker, too. So my point of view, it was a perfect script for Rudy to write.
What did you think of Dylan's acting in Pat Garrett, by the way?
I thought he was rather good.
Yeah.
What's your name, boy?
Alias.
Alias what?
Alias anything you please.
What do we call you?
Alias. Hell, just call him Alias. That's what I'd do.
I actually think Rudy introduced Dylan to Peckinpah because he hoped that Peckinpah would cast Dylan as Billy.
Mm.
But
wow.
Peckinpah was more comfortable with Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
And but Kris Kristofferson doesn't really seem to be the type of Billy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't look like that little kind of scrawny guy that mm-hmm. Dylan did look like at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would love to have seen that film with Kristofferson's fine in it. He does a good job, but I think that to see Dylan play Billy the Kid would have been really interesting.
It winds up, Walker, getting you, you've said, blacklisted.
Yes. It's so sad. I was never able to work for the studios again.
Was it just the politics of Walker that turned them off?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You all might think that there will be a day when America will leave Nicaragua alone. But I'm here to tell you, flat out, that day will never happen. Because it is our destiny to be here. It is our destiny to control you people. So no matter how much you fight, no matter what you think, we'll be back. Time and time again.
Well, Lorenzo O'Brien, who was the producer, and I both thought that we were making, this sounds ridiculous, right, but we were making a kind of popular comedy. Because
mm-hmm.
we thought, essentially, you know, our aesthetic is not that far removed from Blazing Saddles, you know, and the film has violence, it has sex, it has beautiful women,
it
has exotic locations.
And Joe Strummer music.
It's got Joe Strummer music. It's got a great performance by Ed Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, though, it wasn't perceived that way by the studio who distributed it, who saw it as a troublesome and difficult film.
Well, you kept very busy. I mean, people probably recognize those 80s works as kind of like the prime Alex Cox period, but you've been extremely busy since then. You've made documentary films. You've authored a number of books, right? I mean,
yeah. But you know what's interesting also is, and this is kind of good. If I had become really rich, suppose I had, I mean, not that Joe was necessarily mega rich, but Joe had super large number of residuals coming in from The Clash.
Yeah.
Musicians actually are much better treated than filmmakers in terms of getting a little bit of money back from very popular albums and songs. And so if I'd been in Joe's situation and been very comfortable financially, I could, like Joe, have just kind of kicked back for 15 years and not done anything.
I think Joe was a little adrift, too. I think he just felt a little lost there for a period. It wasn't so much a laziness as just, you know, what do I do? What do I do next?
Yeah,
you know?
I wouldn't say he was lazy because he wasn't. But I think that he, after Walker, he'd hoped that maybe there was an entree there in terms of film scoring and acting. But that didn't really kick off. Then he did this album, Earthquake Weather. And the hope was that that was going to get him into sort of the American market as a solo rocker. Earthquake Weather didn't take off either.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think at that point, it wasn't laziness, it was more a lack of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And a lack of confidence coupled with an income meant that he could literally retire for a decade and a half, you know, and hang out in the country. But I never had that luxury because I always needed to make a living.
You had to work.
Yeah, you got to work, right?
Coup d'etat.
We have been talking to the great director, Alex Cox. Alex, thank you so much for coming into Sound Opinions.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now we want to hear from you. What's your take on Walker, Sid and Nancy, Repo Man, or any of Alex Cox's films? What movie screams punk to you? Let us know on our hotline, 888-859-1800, or find us on Twitter or Facebook. When we come back, we'll review the new album from NERD, and I'll share a song I can't live without on the Desert Island Jukebox. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Armies marching through the streets, dressed up sharp, dressed real neat. Good day, dog. Good day, dog. A push from the left and a shove from the right. It's all planned out. We'll do it tonight. Push the president and his wife. Hoping for ransom or take their lives. Attack their embassy. They are our enemies. The president is smoking cigars. Anyone he does not like, he shoots or puts behind bars. Coup d'etat.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that's a track from the new NERD record called No One Ever Really Dies. The track is called Deep Down Body Thirst. NERD, well described by you, Jim, as sort of Pharrell Williams' garage band, and that's where what he's returning to with this record. This is the fifth studio album by this group. Basically started out with Pharrell Williams and Chad Hugo as his production team, signed by Teddy Riley in the 90s. The Neptunes, they went on to make 24 top 10 hits on the Billboard charts, working with artists like Jay-Z and Britney Spears, Busta Rhymes, Daft Punk, but also quirkier, more left-field acts like Khalees. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. And around this era, when they were working with these huge artists, they started working in this, what became a trio, with their friend Shay Haley. They made a total of four records during that era. Now the first NERD record in 7 years, a hiatus during which Pharrell Williams basically became a solo star with that huge hit Happy, working with Daft Punk, and producing that wonderful Oscar-winning movie Hidden Figures. Here's a track from the new NERD record, No One Ever Really Dies. It's called ESP on Sound Opinions. You got energy, uh-huh, but you ain't gonna use it. Uh-huh. You got so much time, uh-huh, but you ain't gonna use it. You got so much space, uh-huh, but you ain't gonna use it. Uh-huh. You got a great big mind, but you ain't gonna use it. Uh-huh. We got this energy, uh-huh, but you ain't gonna use it. Uh-huh. You got so much light, but you ain't gonna use it. Uh-huh. You got such good taste, uh-huh, but you ain't trying to use it. Uh-huh. All the sign to your brain, uh-huh, but you ain't trying to use it. Uh-huh. You got an extra eye, but you ain't trying to use it. Uh-huh. Remember what you find, uh-huh, 'cause we finna lose it. Hey! Walking around with the energy of the hot summers. Yeah. Yeah. Spreading the wind and illuminating, yeah, degrees. Yeah. Yeah. The evil incarnates, they wanna take it from us. Yeah. Yeah. But I walk with a force that can penetrate, yeah, my beliefs. Yeah. Yeah. Hey! Weapons, yeah, of mass destruction. Yeah. Yeah.
That is ESP from NERD album number 5, No One Ever Really Dies. Greg, both that track and the one we bumped in with, Deep Down Body Thirst, are two of the rare tracks on this album that are really just Pharrell Williams. It's hard even to tell how much Chad Hugo, or the third member of NERD, who nobody mentions, Shay Haley, how much they're even on this record. There are a whole lot of guests. Some of them are very successful. Rihanna really brings it, and with a vengeance. I love that track, Lemon.
With a lemon. Wait a minute. Not cause she ain't living. It's just your eyes get acidic. And this ain't a scrimmage.
Kendrick Lamar, you know, is a genius. Mm-hmm. Both of us had him on our top 10 albums of 2017 list. I think that track, Don't Do It, is a standout. You better duck while fat from the mania. Don't stare, don't laugh at the mania. Break free, press gas when the india. Don't let it go bad when the india. Highway, get out the way. Black man, do your greatest game. Black man, want to prosecute you. Raise your hand up with this. I love that Pharrell gets political for the first time with Kendrick. There are other collaborations that do not work at all. The album ends with Ed Sheeran trying to get in a reggae vibe, and boy, that doesn't succeed. This is a garage band, and it is an experimental one. It's Pharrell, who is obviously a genius, you know, in terms of both musical invention and connecting with great pop hits, sometimes for the better. Happy makes the world a better place. Blurred Lines, kind of a problematic hit there, Pharrell. That's a subject for another day. You know, here, the best songs kind of sound like Happy, and the rest is I'm messing around in the studio with my pals, making an awesome noise. I think I've come around on NERD opposite of where I used to be. I remember us fighting years ago. Maybe it was album number 2 or 3. I was defending them, saying, let the guy have his fun in the studio. But then I realized I've never listened to that record again, you know? And so I think on our buy it, try it, trash it scale, the best enthusiasm I can give it is a try it.
You know, Pharrell is one of those guys who likes to wear hats, you know? He's a hat guy.
Yeah, some of them are pretty goofy, famously, yes.
And I'm thinking if he picked a hat for this one, it would be one of those Swami turbans, you know? It's just kind of like I see him on a black light poster. It's a very psychedelic record.
It is.
I love Pharrell. Yeah. They've always been quirky, and I love it when Pharrell does quirky. He started his career as sort of this left-field character making these pop hits. It's almost like he's forgetting about making hits and just making records because, you know, he can be self-indulgent because he's Pharrell Williams. You know, you mentioned the guest list. It's almost like, why do we need all these guest stars? Like, we know you have a great Rolodex or whatever they call it these days.
And they all owe you, yeah.
But other than that, it's you know, I like this record just for the tone, that sort of weird, buzzy character to the record. Talk about the psychedelic theme. He's talking about rising above these sort of worldly troubles that we have. You know, that track ESP, you got an extra eye, but you ain't trying to use it, you know? Mm-hmm. He's almost saying, get outside yourself. So I like this record better than you, Jim. I think primarily because of the adventurousness in the arrangements. I don't hear a lot of, you know, so-called R&B pop funk records like this in this era. And for that reason, I'll give it a buy it.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible, we like to take a trip out to the desert island and pop a quarter in the desert island jukebox to play a track we cannot live without. Jim, you've got the first DIJ of 2018. What's it going to be?
Well, Greg, I was thinking about New Year's Eve and the many I spent at Maxwell's in Hoboken, and I can't remember for the life of me the year, but there was a great year when Human Switchboard played and ushered in the new year. Human Switchboard is a band with a pedigree in two places. They were a key part of the scene in Ohio, Cleveland, and later Columbus in the late 70s, fellow travelers with Pear Ubu and the Numbers Band. Then they moved to New York and were just in time for the explosion of what now, you know, sounds strange to even say, new wave dance music, right? People used to go out and dance to new wave rock and roll, you know, in the 80s, especially in New York. Nobody dances to rock and roll anymore, you know. And Human Switchboard was one of the best bands in delivering this mix of funky, punky garage rock with great funk. R&B. I always think of them in a similar vein of ESG, which were even funkier, you know, but rock and roll cross-pollinating with nascent house music and funk. A later member of Switchboard was the wonderful bassist Jared Michael Nickerson. He's a long-running great in the New York dance underground with a group called Burnt Sugar Orchestra. But the two Ohioans who were the heart and soul of Human Switchboard were Bob Pfeiffer and Myrna Markarian. Myrna played a wonderful garage rock organ, but also a little bit of like Bernie Worrell, funkadelic kind of keyboards. Bob Pfeiffer is a problematic character. He was the guitarist, vocalist, songwriter, later became, you know, weirdly the president of Disney-owned Hollywood Records and went down in a federal indictment for wiretapping. Mm-hmm. The music lives on. A couple of years ago, Bar None Records put out a wonderful anthology, Who's Landing in My Hangar, 1977 to 84. There was only one real Human Switchboard album, but many great songs. I'm going to play one of Myrna's, Say No to Saturday's Girl by Human Switchboard on Sound Opinions. Say No to Saturday's Girl by Human Switchboard, my Desert Island Jukebox pick for the week. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
I quite like that band, Jim, and we quite like the band that we're going to have on next week. Actually, it's the founder and the driving force in the band Iron and Wine, Sam Beam, with a live performance and interview.
Greg, Sound Opinions was produced by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, and Iona Contreras. And for the last time, Evan Chung, we're bidding him farewell as he moves to New York to work at Studio 360. Evan's done great stuff on the show, making it happen every week, number one, but also some well-produced pieces, The Bass Six and the story behind Convoy. You owe all that to Evan. We'll miss you, Evan. Good luck in New York.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Put your number in my phone. Put your number in my phone. I hope to get some time alone. I want to get to know you more, baby.
New messages.
Hi, this is John calling from Philadelphia. I was calling regarding your In Memoriam show and somebody I thought was overlooked, but understandably so. Frankie Paul was a classic reggae singer. He died May 18th. He was one of the first reggae artists to make it huge in that era coming out of the early 80s. He was not like a hardcore Rasta and didn't always sing about Rasta. He sang over so many classic rhythms, songs like Worries in the Dance, I Know the Score, Pass the Kushon Peng. Anyway, Frankie Paul, I thought, deserves love. So anyway, sort of bring it to your attention. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Hi, my name is Gary. I'm out of Zion, Illinois. One of my greatest influences of my life is the guitarist Alan Holdsworth. He died April 2017. This man revolutionized jazz fusion, playing on guitar with his legato styling, his voicings, his exotic chords, his soloing style, the use of harmonic notes, disharmony. His style has influenced so many jazz fusion guitarists and guitarists. Alan Holdsworth was Eddie Van Halen's favorite guitarist, Eric Johnson's favorite guitarist. Alan Holdsworth was one of the greatest influences on jazz fusion and many other guitarists.
Hello, my name is Reginald. I'm in Rogers Park. I just listened to your end-of-the-year mixtape show, and thank you once again, guys, for some very good recommendations. I'm always looking for new music. You did mention that Malcolm Young passed away, you know, based in D.C., and you didn't give a mention at all of his brother, George Young, who produced all of the early AC/DC albums, all the, you know, the Bon Scott era albums. He was in the Easy Beats in the 60s, you know, that they only had the one really, you know, notable hit in America, Friday on My Mind. He probably deserved a little bit of a mention, I at least in passing. Anyway, thanks again for, you know, doing what you do, basically. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Marguerite, and I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. Willie Pickens, the famous jazz musician, pianist, percussionist, teacher at the American Conservatory of Music, passed away. And he also was a Chicago public school teacher, a church musician, and just a renowned international, humble man. Loved by all who met him, who heard him, who knew him. He was my brother's guitar teacher, classical guitar teacher, but he also taught adults. You run the gamut. He taught it. If it was a musical instrument, he knew it. Okay, thanks so very much, and that's to 2017. Hopefully for another great 2018, continued success in your shows. Thank you. God bless, and bye-bye.
Messages. To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.